Back together again, you and I, chatting on Thursday, October 26, 2023, on Connecticut Today. I began the program with the latest details on a mass shooting in Maine. Also joining us, University of New Haven criminal justice senior lecturer and former FBI agent Ken Gray. He had his thoughts on that Maine shooting. And, of course, our weekly check-in with Only in Bridgeport blogger Lenny Grimaldi.
Tough to come on and at least start shows like the one today with the story that's, you know, dominating the news, and there's obviously a whole lot to get to, just a pile of stuff to get to. But whenever you have any one of these horrific mass shootings here, it's hard not to talk about the story. But this one in particular is, well, listen, any mass shooting, any taking of a human life, unless it is in the process of protecting your own life from a possible criminal occurrence, or protecting the ones you love, or a husband or a wife or a spouse or kids or parents or whatever, you know, with those small exceptions, the taking of a human life for people who are mentally sane is something that is tough to understand. But there really is a simple understanding here of what happened in Maine. You have this guy, this suspect, everybody's looking for him, 40-year-old Robert Card here, who, you know, is the suspect in the killing of at least 16 people at a restaurant and bowling alley in Lewiston, Maine last night. At least another 13 or so injured. The numbers here are, you know, rather different from outlet to outlet here. But again, we find out, because as I say all the time, things like this, you shouldn't say never, because some of these shootings, a very small handful of these shootings, actually go unsolved with no reason for them. But again, you have shootings like this where you know almost, well, obviously not immediately, but when I saw this news break last night, I said, okay, it's not going to be long before we find out, you know, sadly, what the reason is for this. And we find out that this mass shooter, this Robert Card, had apparently, in the not-too-distant past, been, you know, was under some sort of short-term mental illness care. The man here says here in this story on Newsmax, the Army reservist, suspected of killing 18 people at least in Maine, had been taken by police for an evaluation in mid-July after military officials became concerned he was acting erratically. That's according to the AP. The official said commanders in the Army Reserve's 3rd Battalion, 304 Infantry Regiment, became concerned in mid-July, so this was just a few months ago, that 40-year-old Robert Card was acting erratically. This, while that unit was training at the U.S. Military Academy in West Point. Now, the official said military commanders became concerned about Card's safety and asked the police be called. New York State Police took Card to the Keller Army Community Hospital at West Point for an evaluation. The official was not authorized to publicly discuss info about the incident and spoke to the AP on condition of anonymity. And again, this is the frustrating part of these cases. Almost always, and I'm not going to say always, because there are exceptions in some of these attacks where you find out, and even years down the road, you know, you have exceptions where people never really come up with a motive for some of these killings, but more often times than not, you know, they do, as the manhunt continues here. So again, this automatically triggers us to a discussion of red flag laws. Maine apparently has what is called a yellow flag law, which is not as encompassing as a red flag law. And all with that, Maine's gun laws are not overly strict because of where it is. And you know, that part of northern New England, Vermont, Maine, northern New Hampshire, you know, guns are almost an afterthought in that area. And one thing that I am, I don't want to say pleased is the word, because you're never really pleased with anything in a horrible situation like this. But one thing I have noticed from the coverage in this one, at least the people in my business are being somewhat responsible and saying, hey, this sort of thing is not usual in Maine. I think they said Maine over the course of last year had 28 or 30 homicides or something like that. So to try and compare that to perhaps a situation where, you know, somebody is talking about New York or Boston or Seattle or Cleveland or even, you know, cities here like in Connecticut, Bridgeport, Hartford, New Haven, doesn't make any sense. Now, Maine has what's called a yellow flag or yellow paper law. It's a process with more steps than the red flag laws that are in certain other states that end up ultimately having you surrender your firearms in select cases. Maine has what's called extreme risk protection orders that can be used for law enforcement officers to take firearms from people at risk of using guns to harm themselves and others. But in Maine, it only goes into effect when a law enforcement officer has taken a person into protective custody. So that means in Maine, as it's explained here from one of the TV station websites, I'm seeing this in Maine, that means in Maine, any person in question must have had a run-in with the law. Then, says here, a medical practitioner must assess whether that person presents a likelihood of foreseeable harm. Now, some people in Maine say that's a hindrance to this whole thing. A report pushes for more resources and education about what the law can do. On and on and on. So the bottom line is, you know what? You hate to say something like this, but I was watching all these, you know, the breaking news of this last night and seeing the stories come in, and I was getting alerts on my phone and another mass shooting. And you know, when you see Bowling Alley in Maine, you're thinking, oh, my God, all those kids and people there. And then you read about this guy's history, and it's frustrating because, again, as recently as mid-July, some people, I guess, in his army unit had to call the cops to take him in. And then we really, at least now, you don't know what happens. Now, we, I guess, don't know yet. I'm sure the FBI and the police and law enforcement are making checks here to say, well, whether, you know, how long has he had these guns? Was he a legal gun owner? I guess the guy's some sort of a petroleum or ordnance specialist here. So the question begs, and I know there are a lot of people out there who are very passionate Second Amendment people, as I am, and I've never fired a live round of ammunition. And I've always insisted that we need to be careful when doing something may strip someone, maybe, of a constitutional right. But in this situation, what do you do? Now, I'm sure there's more info that's going to come out about this, but what are your thoughts on this whole thing? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. So, for example, and they're being very, all the officials around this whole thing are being very circumspect about what they say, because there are legalities here, and you have the HIPAA regulations, and you know how that is. Any discussion of anybody's mental or physical health is not authorized unless they themselves authorize it. But apparently this guy had been taken by police for an evaluation after officials became concerned that he was acting erratically, and I guess he had made mention to some people about voices in his head. I mean, look, I'm not a licensed psychiatrist or a psychologist or ever, but man, you know, you hear that, and it's frustrating because you hear this. The average person hears this, right? Doesn't have to be somebody with a doctorate or somebody who works in the field. The average person hears this, and they say, again, another red flag, another yellow flag. And it continues to be frustrating because, as I say, these things rarely happen in a vacuum. Sometimes they do. There are some mass shooting attacks that, even after being looked at and researched for years, the best criminologists, the best crimes experts cannot figure out what happened. In this one, we at least have a clue, which again begs the question and lends us to wonder here. And you can drop in here. We'll get it underway with this at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Without knowing exactly what went down in that mental health evaluation this guy had, without knowing that, should the possible effects, the severity, the strength of a red flag law or a yellow flag law, should these laws be, how should I put this? Should they err on the side of caution more as far as making sure someone doesn't hurt themselves or others? Should there be fewer levels that have to be looked at, or fewer hoops that have to be jumped through rather than more, to at least for the time being, institutionalize someone and or make sure that they, at least until the final evaluation is made, at least make sure that they don't have access to guns like this? I mean, think about what that guy did last night. Oh, my God. At least 18 people. On a busy midweek Wednesday are dead, at least another 13 hurt. Horrible. Just god-awful. But again, is this the kind of thing, and I hate to use the word put up with, but in a society that has, in this country, what, 400 million guns? Is this the kind of thing that you don't have to condone, but on some level you say that, well, this is what's going to happen when we have relatively easy access to guns? All right, we'll get back to open phones in just a bit. When we do that, it'll be at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Guest now to tell you about, he has been with us before, and we usually have him on when we have scenarios like this, high-profile law enforcement involvement in some pretty tragic events, University of New Haven Criminal Justice Senior Lecturer, former FBI agent as well, Ken Gray joins us. Ken, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Hi, Paul. Good to talk to you again.
Well, good to talk to you, Ken, and to get your expertise on this. So they're looking for this guy, Ken, who allegedly, he is a person of interest, not a formal suspect yet, allegedly kills 18 people at a couple of locales last night, injures 13 others. They found his car, Ken. He's on the run, so you take me back to your experience in law enforcement and the FBI. How do you find one guy, Ken, who might be armed, we don't know, and was last actually seen almost a day ago in two spots in one state? How do you guys do that?
So, Paul, this is a complex investigation that has a lot of moving parts. You have the crime scene. You have an investigation going around talking to family members, to former people that worked with them, to neighbors. And then you have the manhunt itself, and you have evidence being collected at the crime scene. So, as I say, a lot of moving parts. For the manhunt itself, the place to start is the last known location. So he dumped his car in another town in Lisbon out by the boat dock there. Mm-hmm. And so you start your physical search there from the last known location. However, because of the length of time that has passed since then, if he had pre-staged another car, or if he carjacked someone, or if he hopped onto a waiting boat there, he could be anywhere by now. But nonetheless, you have to start locally and then expand outwards, but also use all means possible to include results of interviews with family members and with friends to tell where he might be headed for.
Yeah, I was going to just I'm glad you mentioned that, Ken Gray. So that would be, from what I've heard, kind of standard procedure. You talk to any brothers, sisters, parents, whatever, and what, you try to get a key locale. If there's some commonality that they all mention, you alert law enforcement in those areas, correct?
That's correct. I mean, he's from that area, so this is not a person that is unknown that picked a random target. He's from that area. He had been at that bowling alley. He had been at that that bar and grill. He thought people were talking about him at those locations, according to family members. So this is personal. This is something that is he is there at that that local area. So there are local places that he might feel comfortable at, and family members might know where he had camped at before, or where he might have a cabin at somewhere, or other pieces of information like that that might help track him down. But this is a local guy, so he's more than likely somewhere local.
And Ken, I would imagine, although there are people that don't like the fact that this is used, but law enforcement does use it, and sometimes they mention it, sometimes they don't, things like facial recognition software and all the video and everything, that's obviously being used as well, right?
So we live in a surveillance society. There are cameras everywhere, and so that type of information is certainly useful. However, he is in Maine. The town that he carried out this act in has 36,000 people in it, and it's the second largest city in Maine. So we're talking about a rural area. And so tools like that might be very useful in a much higher population density area may not be quite as useful. However, maybe he has a cell phone with him. His family members give you his cell phone number, and then you go and you start searching for that cell phone. You can find the person, if you have their cell phone, to see where their cell phone is pinging into what repeater at. And so he can be found if he has a cell phone just based upon that alone.
Ken Gray is the guest from the University of New Haven. Ken, the other aspect of this is interesting, and this came out relatively quickly last night. He is some sort of munitions and or firearms expert in the Army, and we find out as recently, Ken, as this past summer, that he was acting erratically enough to where his unit, the commanders in his unit, they were on some sort of drill in and about near West Point. They had him committed to a hospital. Supposedly, sources are saying this. But, Ken, I think you've told me before, if I'm not mistaken, in other investigations, that even though you're dealing with somebody who may have committed heinous crimes, it's not that easy for you guys and gals in law enforcement to get a hold of medical records, is it?
That's exactly right. Now, if he was committed to, for examination for mental illness, that those records can be obtained. Personal health documents are hard to get, but in a case like this here, where it is crucial for investigative steps, that kind of information can be obtained with court orders. But here's the thing is that here in the state of Connecticut, we have red flag law.
Mm-hmm.
He would not have had access to weapons had it occurred here because of that. But up in Maine, they don't have red flag laws. They have something called yellow flag law.
Yeah.
And that is not as strong a restriction on possession of firearms for people who have made threats. But nonetheless, had this been pushed further, he would not have had access to the weapons that he had access to. He was a firearms instructor with the Army. He was a certified firearms instructor and also a tactical instructor. So this makes this into a very dangerous person to be going after. So when law enforcement does track him down, they're going to have to approach him very carefully.
Yeah, Ken, what do you think? And I know this is tough to put odds on, but I'm sure that there are some people in law enforcement, Ken, that would not be surprised. It may not work out this way if, in fact, he ends up taking his own life. Now, we don't know whether that's going to happen, but I know that's something that I've read and seen today that's been discussed heavily.
That's always a possibility. So this type of mass shooter is called a pseudo-commando. And pseudo-commandos dress militarily, they carry military weapons, and often pseudo-commandos end up with suicide by cop. They want to get involved in a shootout with cops, and they want the cops to kill them. So that might be the end result of this. However, this person does have mental illness, so we don't know if he's thinking rationally or not. We don't know if that's his intent.
Ken Gray, University of New Haven, senior lecturer there, criminal justice, long background in criminal justice, and 2 decades plus with the FBI. Ken, as always, good to chat with you on this stuff, and we'll chat down the road. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Appreciate it. So there you go, folks. It's not easy. I mean, you know, here's one guy, as Ken said, who was known in an area, so obviously he's from there, so when you're in a situation, you know all the nooks and crannies, and who knows? I mean, did he, for lack of a better phrase, did he off, you know, himself? Is he on the run? Boy, I don't envy law enforcement here. 203-333-9422-333-WICC. Do you ever, and I kind of find myself doing this as well, but when things like this happen, whether it's Newtown, whether it's the I-91 music festival shooting, whether it's the supermarket shooting in Buffalo, whether it's this shooting here or that school in Uvalde, Texas, we hear and see these all the time. Do you find yourself scared to go into populated areas? Just places that you would go. A bowling alley here. I mean, who thought last night that their life or lives would end at a bowling alley on Wednesday night? Isn't Wednesday night? I haven't bowled in years. Isn't Wednesday night like league night, where a lot of the bowling alleys are busy and jamming? I mean, who would think you go somewhere like this and somebody, and you can't harden a bowling alley. I mean, it's not like a school where, you know, you can check the locks on the doors. They can only open one way. You've got bullet-resistant glass. You've got codes to get into the building. You've got security people that have to see your face and ask who you're coming to see. Now, it's not like a school. This is a bowling alley and a restaurant previous or after that. But, you know, do you find yourself in, when you're in, I don't know, malls or locations like this? I mean, you know, I do sometimes. I mean, you know, I look around where there's a lot of people, and I don't think it's paranoia because it happens. And you look around and you say, hey, how would I get out of here? And it's sad we have to think that way. But I always, you know, find myself looking around if I'm ever in populated places, which as the older I get, the more I don't like to be in. But I'm like, okay, there's an exit there, and there's an exit there. And how often do we hear those announcements? Right? Whether we're in concert locations, ballparks, ball games, entertainment facilities, movie theaters. You know, you get kind of this warm, fuzzy sort of welcome. How do they say it? Please familiarize yourselves with the emergency exit should something like that be necessary. Right? You say to yourself, well, the exit's over there, but would I be able to get out in enough time? Seriously, I was thinking about that. I went to a movie about 2 or 3 weeks ago. I'm saying to myself, what if somebody just came in here and, you know, did the unspeakable? Toby in Bridgeport this afternoon. Toby, good afternoon. How are you, sir?
I'm fine. How you doing?
I'm good, Toby. What's on your mind today?
Yeah, because of the gun laws. I mean, a lot of liberals, they say that, if you take away the past stricter gun laws, that's going to prevent people from using the guns around the country. Well, guess what? There are about over 500 million guns around the nation right now. That is going to be very difficult, number one.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, first, as a country, we are not really dealing with our mental health crisis.
Mm-hmm.
We have serious mental health crisis. And this guy is one of the serious examples.
Yeah, Toby.
Maybe he has an antisocial personality disorder or
schizophrenia. I mean, who knows?
Schizophrenia. Who knows?
Yeah, and Toby, as I always say, I don't care how big the gun is. If you are of sound mind, what do they say? If you're of sound mind and body, you're not going to do something like this. I don't care how many guns you have. You're not going to do it.
He will do it. I mean, like, look at how mental he is. Like,
yeah, you could see. Yeah,
could see what's going to happen. Like, he's going to do it, like, because he has a serious psychosis.
Yeah. And Toby, thank you. And I know you've worked in that field or studied that. And you're right. In fact, from the eyewitness accounts that I read last night before I went to bed late, I was up for a few hours following this. They did interview some people who were at the bowling alley who were able to escape, and they all said there's some sort of commonality to this where they said he was expressionless. I mean, think about that. For all of us amateur psychiatrists and psychologists, and please, I'm not trying to be funny, but, you know, we all think we try to figure something out. Somebody who does this kills 18, wounds at least another 13, and don't be surprised if these numbers change. But how many times do you hear this where they say somebody who can actually see a gunman's face, some of these situations, you know, people don't look the gunman in the face or they're wearing a hood or something. But think of all the times that people say he or she was expressionless. That tells you something. I think I'm going to apply for the Bridgeport election monitor because apparently nobody's got the gig yet. Hey, it's $150,000, right? Well, you know, somebody has to know the layout of Bridgeport to get the job. You have to know the intricacies. No, you don't. No. Put me in that seat. Here's a guy I know that would be my best reference. Lenny Grimaldi, only in Bridgeport.com. Lenny, wouldn't I be perfect for that gig? Come on, man.
Uncle Paulie, how dare you take a day off tomorrow? Maybe that's why you're taking a day off to apply for the job.
Yeah, I'm sitting down with
Steph. You have an interview tomorrow. You have an interview for this job tomorrow.
Yeah, all right. Now that you blew the lid off it, Lenny, there you go. Yes, folks, I am applying for the job that, Lenny, it isn't filled yet. This is a comedy act. What's going on here?
As they say, it's a very narrow, as they say, a very narrow skill set. And who really wants it? So in the past, you know, the courts have designated local lawyers, to serve in this role.
Mm-hmm.
They've carved out, this is, you know, my sense is this is like a 2-year process, right? And they've carved out $150,000 for this. I mean, Max Medina, a local lawyer who's now on the Superior Court bench, he would have this role. I had a couple of situations where Judge Bellis appointed him to serve in this kind of role to oversee, you know, local elections. But the gene pool apparently is very small. They don't have a lot of people applying for this thing.
The gene pool.
And, yeah. And so they're going to say, let's extend it out a little bit more and see what happens. Meanwhile, this is the penultimate weekend, right, before the November 7th general election. And there's still a lot of decisions to be made, including what Judge William Clark's going to do.
So what's he going to, you know, Lenny, you and I both know judges hate to order redos. They don't want to get into it because, oh, if I do the redo, then the other side says, well, then you're disenfranchising all the people who already voted. Do you have a gut feeling on this, Lenny? Are we really going to get a redo on the primary here? Or is the judge going to say, you know what? Everybody's on the ballot anyway. What's the point?
It could be. You know, it really could be. It's a really tough call. You know, the PR side of me is saying that, yeah, he'll probably order it. And all my legal friends say, Lenny, the plaintiff didn't meet the standard. So I posted on my site only in Bridgeport today the legal briefs that were filed yesterday.
Okay.
And there'll be follow-up briefs tomorrow. And here's the short version of what the defense is saying. Defense is saying, not one city voter was called to the stand to say their vote didn't count.
Mm.
That is basically a very small window into what the defense is arguing. William Bloss, who's a very talented lawyer representing John Gomes, says all this stuff amounts to there's no other reason. I mean, there's no other decision other than to throw this out because of the number of ballot stuffing that went into these absentee ballot boxes. So again, the defense is saying, you know, for the judge to overturn this case, there has to be 251 ways. And Bill Bloss, for whatever reason, decided he didn't want to bring any voters to the stand to say that my vote didn't count, probably because the process takes so much longer, you know, to actually do that kind of research.
Mm.
And to bring people to the stands. And so, you know, so tomorrow the judge will hear a final briefs. He may very well make a decision Monday or Tuesday. And if it is on Tuesday or Wednesday, now you're talking just days from the general election November 7th, which is going to take place. There will be a general election no matter what this judge determines on this case. And either way, the losing side is going to appeal to the United States. I'm sorry, the Connecticut Supreme Court. And how long will that process play out? So, you know, we'll see.
A lot of billable hours. Now, Lenny, the other kind of scoop you had a few days ago, and I believe Maria Pereira was on this morning with Melissa. The scoopage you had there about not being allowed in a senior housing complex, to which I think she responded, it's all political. There's nothing there. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, she always says that. That's Maria Pereira's knee-jerk line to any time she is accused of any wrongdoing. Unfortunately, I have spoken and done a lot of reporting on this, talking to a number of seniors, you know, who live in these public housing places, and they say, look, she menaces us, Lenny. You know, she bullies us. Wow. She asks for our absentee ballots. In some cases, they said that, you know, their names were forged on voting documents.
Wow.
And so, you know, this is the head of the housing authority who's saying, we don't want you in our properties because Jillian Baldwin, you know, told me that more than 20 seniors have come to her with complaints about issues that they have with Maria Pereira, who's demanding that they vote a particular way via absentee ballot and so on. So this is par for the course when it comes to Maria Pereira. This is what she does. And if she steps foot on public housing authority again, and then she'll be trespassing. So, but that's pretty typical of what she says.
Lenny, I wanted to touch on this, too. There was a couple of stories written a few weeks back that said, well, one thing the state could mandate or the election monitor could mandate is this, restricted or extra security absentee balloting. But that would only be state mandated for health care facilities with 20 or more beds, of which I think in Bridgeport, Lenny, there are only two. If people wanted to really cut down on the funny business, the managers of these senior complexes, did I read this right? They would have to ask or mandate that there only be like a day or two, like an absentee day here and there to make sure there's, security there and the town clerks, a Democrat and Republican there, making sure it's all on the up and up. You see that possibly happening or not?
Well, yeah, you're talking about basically supervised ballot.
Yeah, yeah.
Which has happened. If there's 20 or more requests, local elections officials can do that. And that has happened.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if, I haven't checked in the last few days with elections officials if anything was on board to do that. But yeah, that's a situation where if you have 20 more requests for absentee ballots, there can be supervised balloting, which elections officials will go in there and have a designated day where people can come in and cast mm-hmm. a vote. Via absentee ballot. So that has happened in the past. It's something that could happen in the future. I've got to check to see if any of that's going on. So right now we're talking about, we're like 12 days or so away from the general election.
All right. A couple of things before we wrap up with your old boss. Which I know you love talking about, the Testo's property, the apartments there, a timeout called here, Lenny, and what do you think happens there? Do the developers there try and push, as I've heard and I've talked to people here, a smaller development? Because there's been at least a timeout here where it looks like, at least at this point, the neighbors kind of won here for the moment.
Yeah, I think the developers are going into court. The developers feel like they're on the side of the angels. With the law, right? And so I think they're going to go into court and see how it plays out. So what happened was the zoning board, they didn't get the enough votes, right, to overturn it.
Mm-hmm.
They needed another vote or two. So technically they voted like that the developer's correct, but they didn't have enough votes to get there. Cause I think they needed like a 2/3 thing or something like that on the vote, and they came up short. So the developers say, hey, we're going to go to court and see how it plays out. Will they do something less? I'm not sure what this developer can do to persuade residents of the North End that they're going to small this development so there's not as much density. So my sense is that I go to court and see how it plays out.
And finally, Lenny, we cannot let you go every Thursday here mm-hmm. without getting your views about your old boss, Mr. Trump, who now, when we talked last week, you were rolling the dice here that he was looking for some place that he could escape to and get on
I have identified the country.
Why? Where's he going?
He's going to fire up the jet.
Yeah.
And he's going to fly to Indonesia. And he's going to play golf with the Komodo dragons. He's going to be king of Komodo Island. Think about that. You ever see these monitor lizards, these Komodo dragons? They're monsters. They could be his caddy. They're going to be his caddy, and he could be king of the Komodo. I think there are more Komodo dragons on that island than people.
So that's where he's going. And we don't have an extradition treaty with him. That's your point, right?
No. He could fire up the jet and go to Indonesia, and he could just like Indonesia has what 1,700 islands.
I don't know, Lenny. You're the Indonesia guy. All of us.
Indonesia is the spot.
Yeah.
Komodo, king of Komodo.
The Trump Indonesia course. He got fined again. He got fined in court the other day, Lenny. He may get fined again. How much is he sweating now, do you think? Or not? He doesn't care because he's number one of the polls? What do you think?
Yeah, it's an amazing. Got to give him credit for that. I think this judge, next time around, if he feels like he's straying too far verbally on this kind of case, I think he's going to probably let him cool off for a couple of days. That's going to be my guess. Wow. And the judge has said it, you know, $5,000, $10,000, the next time is going to be more difficult for you. But that's probably going to be my guess. This judge is like, I think he's going to draw a line in the sand. So we'll see if he's a good boy or keeps his mouth shut or he cools him off and does some isolation, as you were talking about earlier.
Lenny, give him a call. Have him arrange a call with him. Have him come on with me. That'd be great. Because I know you got the gist.
I will. No, I'm gonna. He'll come on with you, and we'll make the call from Indonesia.
Okay. The blog is onlyinbridgeport.com. The one and only Lenny Grimaldi. Lenny, thanks. We'll check in next week, my friend. Be good.
Enjoy your time. Thanks
about
a lot.
That, there you go. All right. Yes. So Lenny thinks, he actually thinks, you know, tongue-in-cheek maybe or maybe not, that if things get a little too steamy for Mr. Trump, he may jump on, you know, that, what is that, Trump 1 or whatever he calls it, and just imagine that. Imagine if he got on a plane and just told his pilot, Indonesia, let's go. The weather's good. Here's the flight plan. And he'd never have to come back.